Neighborhood covenants can create confusion, conflict, and at times be grounds for legal action. This month, the University of Arkansas School of Law continued its guest speaker series virtually with Molly Brady discussing covenants in historical and contemporary contexts. Brady is an assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School and is the author of the paper Turning Neighbors into Nuisances. After her participation in the faculty speaker series, she spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the history of covenants and zoning laws. Her research indicates the first such rules, put in place by a private landowner in Boston, excluded Black people and Irish people.
These are now called racial restrictions or racially restrictive covenants. And as you said, they begin here in the Boston area, which is where I am, in about the 1840s. The person who came up with the first one, we know he was sort of an ardent nativist, Boston nativist. And so exactly as you said, sort of sought to prevent Black or Irish people from moving into what was then a suburb and still is a suburb of Boston called Brookline. And that innovation replicated such that huge numbers of property were under racial restrictions. There's a fabulous project out of the University of Virginia, which is a former institution that I taught at, and folks that are sort of associated with that, sort of mapping some of these covenants. There are similar projects going on in places like Seattle. Those covenants were only invalidated as unconstitutional, actually, in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. So they really, you know, are not that that much of a relic. And even in the case that ended up invalidating those racial restrictions as sort of unlawful, there were three of the Supreme Court justices were actually recused from hearing that case because they had racial restrictions on their property, which is really striking to think about how prevalent they really were.
Move forward 150, 170, even more years later, we're still having discussions, battles, emotional conflicts over covenants and what kind of homes can be in what kind of neighborhoods. How much connection is there to the covenant and zoning battles of today to those more than a century ago?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think there's a few things. So, you know, the old covenants that I describe in my paper are those that sort of ban slaughterhouses and tenements and other sort of old things that are less of a concern. Today's covenants ban things like solar panels and home sharing. And I think they do likewise kind of influence what we think of as, you know, things we do not want. And then eventually when local governments often go on to take on regulation of these types of things, I think they look to covenants and homeowners associations as models. You know, it is really striking a statistic. You know, in the year 2000, about 1 in 8 people in the United States lived within a homeowners association. Now that number is 1 in 4. And these are really powerful, you know, private governance entities. They often restrict things like speech rights or gun rights or, you know, sort of exactly as you said, like the architecture, the type of house you can build. You know, they're sort of opaque in how they work. A lot of times, homeowners associations, any conflicts with them, they can put a lien on your property. They can also compel you to go into arbitration, you know, if there's a claim that you have against them. So there's really a lot of power in these entities, and I think it's just something we need to pay more attention to.
Now and then, people often paid money for these covenants.
Yeah, it was a premium, you know, I think in the earlier times, the premium came from some benefits that covenants offer that are kind of arcane, but I'll describe them, or at least one of them, which is judges in the early 19th century thought that a nuisance, so you think of that typical offensive land use of a neighbor, had to be underway in order for you to sue to basically enjoin or prevent it. And so if you heard that a slaughterhouse was going into the neighborhood, you would have to wait for the thing to get built, wait for it to become offensive, and only then could you sue to try to get it out of your neighborhood. So these covenants sort of entitled you to get to court faster, because if you had a covenant banning a slaughterhouse, you could immediately sue. And so that's why I think buyers paid a premium for them in the early years. And so now I think there's complicated reasons why people pay a premium to be in HOAs. There are some benefits, right? You know, there might be sort of services that you get. Think about the pool or something that you get as, by virtue of being in a homeowners association, or maybe they have special street cleanup or something. And there's also, I think, signaling effects, right? You know, having the right address, it can be, oh, I live in this, you know, nice neighborhood. And so that might be another reason that people pay a premium for them. So it is kind of complicated. But, you know, I think that there are probably places where there are so many HOAs that, you know, someone might prefer not to be in one, but so much of the property in the municipality is in one that they're sort of stuck being in one, even if it's agreeing to rules that they would prefer not to agree to.
Yeah, you mentioned that some contemporary ownership associations include speech rights. I'm assuming that means what perhaps political signs you may or may not be able to put in your front yard.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the tricky thing is, you know, a lot of the restrictions are drafted in very general ways, you know, so, oh, we only want signage that's smaller than this or only out at this time of year or whatever. But what's interesting is that the enforcement, it's very hard for us to access or see as transparent how these things are enforced. You know, there's been cases sort of bubbling up involving, for instance, this past summer, homeowners associations removing or ordering the removal of Black Lives Matter signs only, but not other signs like graduation signs or other political signage. And so the question about discriminatory enforcement of, you know, ostensibly neutral rules comes up a lot.
And now, of course, POAs or zoning rules that say no multifamily or no apartments. Well, some people need apartments or multi-housing to be able to afford to live. So there is still, more than 100 years later, economic issues involved in all of this.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and, you know, the question becomes, and this comes up even with things, even today, with, you know, things like the large agricultural operations. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the sort of long historical story I tell about how people are trying to keep things like apartments out of their neighborhoods is that, you know, you can see sort of stories that are thinking about how we should cite undesirable land uses. You know, where should we put them? Should we spread them out over a city? Should we concentrate them? And, you know, furthermore, we can see how the decisions of individuals may impose harsh externalities on others. And the HOAs do raise that problem and, you know, just having covenants generally, because if you might choose to ban apartments from your neighborhood, maybe your neighbors all make that choice. If your other neighbors also make that choice, that means eventually, you know, there's no representation for the person that would like to move into your community. And so we go from sort of happy system where people are able to tailor their preferences to an unhappy one where the preferences of a few are really preventing access by others who would, you know, choose to move to the place if they could. So it kind of distorts the market for localities in a way.
And, you know, as recently as this past summer and early fall before an election, we heard warnings that certain candidates wanted to, you know, ruin the suburbs.
Right, right. And I think this is, you know, this is the real challenge. And it's all complicated by, of course, you know, the interaction between school districts and municipal districts, right, where it's not just that a suburb may have the lot shape or the lot size that I want or will permit me to have, you know, a horse or won't permit me to have a horse or whatever I would like, you know, those sorts of choices. Instead, it also affects the kind of school that, you know, my kids are able to go to or things like that. And so I think, you know, that has been the historical problem for land use is how do we ensure that, you know, there's not too much exclusion, but we still permit people to tailor their preferences and live in the kinds of communities they want. And I think generally that has required some level of state oversight to make sure that there's sort of reasonable opportunity in different places for people to, you know, even people of modest means to be able to make a choice such that if they want to live in the, you know, the place that allows horses, they can choose to do that or the one that doesn't. And so I think that the challenge is kind of finding rules that optimize that balance.
And it's interesting, your research into, you know, 18 teens and when zoning and covenants first really start to develop in the United States, we can learn something from reading about 170 years ago about today, right? I mean, this is interesting and still relevant information that you discuss in the paper.
Yeah, and I think there's a few different things. You know, one is it's just striking that deeds and contracts, you know, these sort of dry documents, I think are places where we deliberate on what we perceive to be harmful in ways that end up influencing what comes to be seen as harmful in society at large. You know, if enough times I write down, you know, the color blue is bad, the color blue is bad, eventually I'm probably going to start thinking the color blue is bad, right, or at least that other people think the color blue is bad. And so I think that there's sort of a transmission mechanism of norms that again, is still ongoing, I would say, with even things like solar panels, again, or home sharing, that, you know, we've seen modern HOAs kind of taking those issues on in ways that ultimately shape and affect regulation. I think the other thing is, you know, I just think there needs to be more attention. Right now, there's, you know, a huge movement to sort of address, particularly in the nation's largest cities, single-family zoning, which is, you know, exclusionary, but also harms property owners, prevents them from, you know, making the return that they would like on property if they would like to sell it to someone who's going to develop it into something bigger or whatever. And I think that, you know, that is probably the right first target if you're worried about either restrictions on property or zoning's exclusionary tendencies. But I do think it's worth remembering that private law and these kinds of private covenants can exist behind and can reinforce or have some of the same effects that public law can.
Molly Brady is an assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School and was a recent guest of the University of Arkansas's Faculty Speaker Series. She talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums following her address.